CBSI and the World. I'm John Batchelor. John McMeekin is the author of the new book, Stalin's War. He's a professor at Bard College. Stalin has needled, hectored, used the rhetoric of Second Front for years. Well, here it comes, 1944. We know it as D-Day. However, there are many details inside this before D-Day actually happens. It's important to explore them all. And it has to do with the Lend-Lease. First protocol, second protocol, third protocol. It's not just the dollar figure, which is enormous. It's the ability of the Soviets to plunder the United States. Whole Ford factories. Suitcases of what we call intellectual property. At that time, they would have called them blueprints. Being guarded by NKVD men with submachine guns as they're transferred unopened boxes to the Soviet Union. Sean, I had the image while I'm reading your very careful and shocking explication of not just 70,000 tons of sugar in the first protocol, but those boxes of plans in the third protocol extended. I had this image that all of this equipment, all of these blueprints, all of the technology, all of the pieces of the Ford plant went to some warehouse in the Soviet Union and was never touched. Just a winter outside. Stalin was doing it because this is the highwayman from the Tiflis massacre. Grab as much as you can and think about it afterwards. So did Hopkins know this was happening? Did FDR know this was happening? Did Stettinius, a friend of Hopkins, who will later become the Secretary of State for Truman, for heaven's sakes, but did Stettinius know that they were plundering American technology?
Well, Hopkins certainly knew. I don't think Stettinius knew everything, in part because I don't think Hopkins always revealed everything to him. And I also don't think Roosevelt probably knew the full extent of the story. But Hopkins absolutely did. I mean, there's evidence of Hopkins personally intervening to make sure that this one famous shipment of special chemicals effectively enriched to processed uranium make its way to the Soviet Union. I think Hopkins definitely knew what he was about. He was quite open about it in public. He didn't necessarily give all the details, but he would say, for example, that because the Soviets were going to be so powerful after the war, we should give them whatever they want and desire. He was quite open about that as a policy, even if he didn't reveal all of the details publicly. But yes, as far as you relating this to D-Day, you're right. I mean, what would be the purpose of these vast shipments of intellectual property, of entire factories, pneumatic chain hoists, entire lines, really, of aircraft and tanks being designed to Stalin's specifications, the Boston bomber, the Douglas A-20 Havoc bomber, the P-39 Era Cobra, the diesel Sherman tanks? What would be the purpose of all this being designed, built, and sent to Stalin, if not to aid the army somehow? And they did kind of sort of remember to ask at Tehran, even as Roosevelt was lining up alongside Stalin against Churchill, really, vis-a-vis the kind of priorities that they're ruling out any further operations in the Mediterranean, all the landing craft can be devoted to D-Day. They did remember to ask that Stalin wage a simultaneous offensive in Eastern Europe to draw off strength from D-Day. Well, there was a Soviet offensive earlier that year, a much more kind of subsidiary offensive. The actual offensive, named after Bagration, the commander from the Napoleonic Wars, was actually delayed so that it was not launched until more than 2 weeks after D-Day, so that the Germans were able to transfer troops from the Eastern Front to Normandy and Western Europe. And of course, from Stalin's purpose, that was all to the good and entirely justified. Finally, the Allies were going to bleed and die a little bit. But of course, this opens the field for the Soviet armies, who are now riding on American rubber. And they've got the American Studebakers and Jeeps and tanks and trucks, along with the warplanes and their own equipment, a lot of it manufactured with American steel and aluminum and with American fuel and petroleum. And all of this is now rolling in this massive mechanized army that's going to pour its way from Belorussia eventually into Poland. And eventually, amazingly, in Poland, Stalin actually re-gifts some of his equipment to his Polish communist puppets to go around hunting down Polish home army fighters and American Studebakers and even Harley-Davidson motorcycles. It is a pretty amazing story. And the part about Stalin delaying Bagration, I don't think most people have probably paid much attention to this, in part because there are probably genuine reasons you could delay a military operation. What's more interesting, though, is that Churchill and Roosevelt forgot to ask him about it. And in fact, they just stopped mentioning it in their correspondence after about early April 1944. Admittedly, they're preoccupied with D-Day and all kinds of other problems, and so maybe they just kind of forgot. But they didn't mention it again, and Stalin was quite pleased they didn't call him out on it.
Harry Dexter White at Treasury is identified as an NKVD agent. There are other names to mention. You've mentioned the colonel who takes over in Moscow as an NKVD agent. There is the suggestion over the years that Harry Hopkins may not have been everything we think of him, a devoted servant to FDR. Have you seen anything that you regard credible that Harry Hopkins was an NKVD agent?
I haven't seen anything conclusive, no. I've certainly seen the kind of the rumors and some of the evidence bandied about. But with a lot of these things, you know, if there isn't really enough to make, you know, a firm sort of an opinion. My own hunch or inclination is that in Hopkins' case, it was far more a matter of him being a volunteer. That is to say, just a kind of what we might call an agent of influence, which isn't, he wasn't necessarily regularly reporting to anyone on the Soviet side. He just saw himself as fully devoted to their cause for various reasons. And in the end, I think people like Hopkins were actually more important to furthering Soviet interests than most of the paid agents were, important though they might have been. In the case of Harry Dexter White, I think he was almost certainly important because he was so high up in the Treasury. Alger Hiss, of course, is another name that comes up, and he did have some influence, and he's there at Yalta. You can see him there in the proceedings, and he makes these kind of subtle interventions. But I think in the case of Hopkins, he was probably the most important Soviet asset of all, but he was not an asset in the sense of being on the payroll or reporting regularly to Soviet intelligence. He simply had developed a personal relationship with Stalin and for various reasons, I think, saw Stalin's interests as increasingly his own and was simply devoted to serving them. You know, in a way, really only at one degree removed from the way Roosevelt had come to see Stalin, although Roosevelt kind of had a moment towards the end where he began to doubt some of the wisdom of putting so much of his trust and faith in Stalin. I think Hopkins remained loyal even longer than Roosevelt did.
There were other voices. Averill Harriman to Moscow, ambassador. He challenged Lend-Lease, especially, I believe, the third protocol, maybe the second as well. Third protocol went on after it continued after the war. Was Averill Harriman credible to FDR? Did he have doubts when Harriman challenged what was being transferred? Because Hopkins, whoever challenged Hopkins, he would say, it's legal, I have the power, and that would be the end of the conversation.
Well, that's right. No, Harriman, for a time in 1944, did actually try to exert some type of leverage to try to say that the United States should at least have some say in what the Russians were doing with the equipment that we were sending. And some of it they weren't even using. We're sending these marine diesel engines. We would have been much better off using a D-Day, and the Russians weren't even using them. That was one of the cases they used, that the U.S. should have exerted at least a little bit of leverage. But in this case, yeah, Hopkins simply overruled him. And in the end, I suppose Roosevelt simply sided with Hopkins. I mean, among other things, Hopkins had a huge advantage of proximity. He was literally sleeping in the Lincoln bedroom for almost 4 years during the war. So he's the first person Roosevelt sees and often the last person he sees before he goes to bed. So Hopkins simply had that type of influence that no matter how connected a person like Harriman might have been, by the time he's in the Moscow embassy, you know, he simply doesn't really have the power. I mean, you mentioned Thamenville. I mean, Thamenville was supposedly a U.S. Army officer, but his appointment was not made by the Army. It was made by Hopkins. He reported directly and personally to Hopkins, and Hopkins simply arranged things this way so that he could really outmaneuver and outfox anyone who was trying to really throw any wrench into the works of this rather peculiarly one-sided relationship between the U.S. government and Stalin.
We've gone very fast here, and so we'll turn in the epilogue to pull together some other instances where Stalin gets his way because he is obliged by men as powerful as Winston Churchill. This is Stalin's War. Sean McMeekin is the author. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.